Welcome to the National Bicycle Greenway's Mountain Mover podcast series. Here you will get up close and personal with people who are taking giant steps for the betterment of cyclists and for the planet itself.
Okay, today we're going to the Southern California desert to talk to a new sponsor for our Eagle bicycle ride from San Jose, San Francisco to Boston. I'd like to welcome to the show Kirk Newell, a bike shop owner who has used tragedy to move mountains with his actions every day. Hello, Kirk.
Hi, Martin.
How are you?
Oh, doing pretty good today.
Great. Well, let's get right into the things here. Why don't you tell my listeners, those people who are tuned in, what we're talking about. When you started Kirk's Bike Shop there in Ramona, California?
Well, it was shortly after college, 1977.
77, okay. And I remember from talking to you in 73, you got a degree in, was it Spanish literature from the University of San Diego?
That's right.
Great. And then 4 years later, you become a bike shop owner. What's the connect there? How do the two hang out in the same realm?
Well, I was working in a ski shop, actually, in nearby La Jolla, and I got interested in bicycles and bicycle racing. And eventually, with the retail experience from the ski shop and my interest in bicycles, I decided to open this bike shop in a small town where my wife grew up, about 35 miles from San Diego.
Okay. And when you opened the shop up, you say that was 1977. How big was Ramona? I know it's grown sizably since then. How big was it when you first got into business there?
Yeah, there were about 7,000 people.
Oh my God, 7,000 people. And how many people are there now?
We've got, I believe, about 50,000.
Oh, wow. So back then, when you had your 7,000 people, surely a town that small can't really support a full-service bike shop. Where were your customers coming from?
Well, they were mostly locals. My overhead was extremely low. I rented a 600-square-foot space in a turn-of-the-century building. And just by working by myself, I was able to meet the rent and even, you know, make a little profit immediately, actually.
Wow.
So the shop kind of carried itself from the start with the help of my wife having a full-time job.
So when you say turn-of-the-century building, can you a little bit go into that? Out there in Ramona, there was a building that was built in 1900 and something?
Yeah, this building, I think, was built in something like 02 or 03. It actually was originally the Ike Turner Saloon.
A drinking establishment.
That's right, yeah.
Really?
At least the main portion of it was. And the portion I was actually renting had been added in the 30s. It was kind of tacked onto the side.
Okay, now when I've looked at this in pictures, it's a two-story building. Isn't that what I'm seeing?
No, it's a false front.
Oh, you know, okay.
Authentic false front Western building.
Wow, and it's always been a false front, huh?
Yeah, the middle portion was the saloon, and then the two side portions were tacked on mid-century, you know.
Wow. So how many square feet do you have there in present-day Ramona?
Well, now I've got the center portion and one side, which is about 2,000 square feet.
Oh, my God. And is it filled with bikes, Kirk?
Yeah, it's filled with bikes.
Okay. Now, you sell recumbents, you sell tandems, and you sell regular bikes. Why don't you take us through just a little bit, kind of a broad brush, and what the percentage of all those bikes are that make up the floor space there?
Well, we usually have about 80 bikes on the floor, and maybe 10 or 15% of those are recumbents. Of course, they're recumbents are a little bigger, so they take up a little more space in general.
Mm-hmm.
We have a couple trikes on the floor, and then then some singles. And then tandems, I generally stock three or four tandems, quality tandems from Santana. And then everything else, we cover the spectrum. We have BMX, we have mountain bikes, we have road bikes. So just a little bit of everything.
Awesome. And your test riding turf, what's that look like? I know you had a big fire there. Is there much to see in Ramona? You're in the middle of a desert. Is that not correct?
Well, this is a valley in the foothills between the coast and the mountains. And the actual desert, a real desert is on the other side of the mountains east of us. So we're in more of a what has been for, historically has been an agricultural valley where you pretty much have to irrigate if you're going to grow anything, except for one of the main crops for a long time was oat hay, which was done by dry farming. And my father-in-law was actually a dry farmer, and they would just pray for rain.
Really?
And they we'd get about 10 or 12 inches a year, and that was enough to grow hay.
Really? So, but you had a pretty devastating fire.
Actually had a couple in recent history. We have a weather pattern that shows up during the winter and fall. It's called the Santa Ana winds. And they can kick up, as high as 100 miles an hour. Typically, they blow steadily about 30, and they gust up over 50. In fact, we've got that going on today. It's pretty miserable outside because the temperature's in the mid-50s.
Oh, my God.
So I'm glad I'm inside. But anyway, when conditions are dry and that Santa Ana wind kicks up, it just takes any ignition and the sagebrush and whatever growth there is out in the backcountry just takes off, and walls of fire just get blown across the area.
Wow.
So
the last time you guys had a Holocaust, it was your building was spared. Did a lot of buildings in town go up in flames?
No, the town was pretty well saved. The community lost between 300 and 400 homes.
Wow. 300 and 400 homes. My God.
We evacuated when we saw the fire come over the hill. Stayed with tandem riding friends for 5 days before we could return.
Wow. That's amazing. So, Kirk, it sounds like you got some riding turf there. There's some things to see, yes?
Yeah, we're in kind of a semi-rural area, so all the side roads off of the main highway that comes through town are low traffic, and so it's pleasant riding.
Great.
We often just stay home on the weekend and ride around our valley. We can ride 30 to 50 miles and stay in the valley and have, very little traffic.
Great. So it seems like
nice scenery.
Yeah, I think what I'm trying to understand is you do quite a volume or pretty good business from San Diego, from the West Coast. People coming into your shop in the desert to try recumbents and try tandems. And I guess the reason they come to you is because they know that it's going to be a pleasant experience for them if they've never been on a tandem before or never been on a recumbent before. And so they know it's going to be some safe riding turf for them. Am I understanding that correctly?
Right, yeah. We have some... initially, with recumbents, we actually have a little loop around our shop building itself that doesn't go on the street, so people can get used to the handling a little bit before they actually go on the street.
Excellent. Okay. Awesome. Well, before you got into selling recumbents, you were active in the IHPVA, the International Human Powered Vehicle Association, for people that don't know what that is. And you even had a fully fared recumbent called The Other Woman.
That's correct, yeah.
Can you tell us what it was like to – well, tell me about what it was like to race that against some of the HPV racing legends.
Well, we actually made two versions. Our first edition was semi-successful, and we learned a lot from it. We stuck with the Tadpole trike design on both of our vehicles. But the first one, we thought it would be unique or a good idea to use rear steering. Well, this turned out to be pretty problematic. We did actually get it dialed in, so it worked pretty well. But you still had to know what you were doing to ride this vehicle at speed. We did get it up to about 40 miles an hour at the Speed Championships in 1981 at the Pomona Fairgrounds, mm-hmm, where they ran the 200 meter speed trials were run down the drag strip, and it was slightly downhill, so it helped us get up to 40 pretty easily.
So when you look at 40 and you compare that to, like, was it Worthington's hitting something like 80 now, how does that make you feel?
I'm amazed that they've achieved those speeds, because it was so difficult. Of course, our vehicle was pretty crude. Our fairing was homemade out of aluminum strapping and foam panels and some plexiglass bent over it.
Mm-hmm.
But our second vehicle, which we really tried hard to make a state-of-the-art machine similar to the Vector, which was the number one at the time. By then we'd had, you know, the internet wasn't around, so you couldn't learn too much about things. You had to just speculate.
Mm-hmm.
So we didn't really have, you know, a Vector in front of us until mm-hmm. we went to the championships there at Pomona in 81.
Mm-hmm.
And once we got a chance to look at it, then we made our best copy of it for the 82 championships at the Olympic Velodrome in Carson.
Mm-hmm.
And so this machine was made out of chromoly tubing, and we made a mold and did a full fiberglass fairing using a sailplane canopy to design it around. And this was a lot more successful, but the big stumbling block in designing a really high-speed human-powered vehicle is dealing with ground effects.
Mm-hmm,
so
mm-hmm.
The air tends to get stuffed underneath the vehicle between the nose of the vehicle and the ground, and it slows you down a lot. And because we were designing our vehicle based on the shape of this sailplane canopy, we had a limited shape that we could make, so we had a little problem with our ground effect that kept us from going up over 50.
Mm-hmm.
But even so, the fastest vehicles weren't getting up over 60 at that
mm-hmm.
time.
Right,
so
the jump from
that to 80 is just almost unbelievable.
I know it. Whole other conversation, man. Now, the other woman, was that you called your machine that because was that your wife's idea, your tandem partner, your wife?
That was. Very definitely my wife.
Was she just jealous? She was just jealous because you weren't riding with her?
Well, I built this in, along with a young high school student mm-hmm. who was avid cyclist, Jeff Hedgecock.
Mm-hmm.
And he happened to be very good at working with materials and very artistic. So that... I learned to weld and did the brazing, but he was really good at designing and cutting out materials and so on.
Hmm.
So we made a pretty good team, but we did most of our building in the evenings. So most evenings while we were building these vehicles, I wasn't at home. I was, you know, with the other woman.
Okay. All right. Well, your wife, I understand, is a pretty strong cyclist. And she's like your stoker, and you guys do a lot of tandeming right now. and tandem recumbents and tandem uprights and that type of thing. So you guys still ride a lot then, huh?
We do, yeah. We actually put on a tandem rally every year out in the desert.
Yeah.
Where we get quite a few people coming to ride with us.
Huh. Okay, well, here's the punchline. Here's where it kind of gets to what, in my eyes, elevates you to mountain mover status. Most bike shop owners are just amazing people to begin with. They've got innumerable balls they're trying to keep juggled and keep them afloat just to keep their shops open. But along the way, 11 years ago, your 21-year-old son died in a college water skiing trip. And here now, 11 years later, your shop is stronger than ever. And the Borrego Blast, I think that's what you call that tandem ride, you started to honor his death, and it just keeps growing. What can you tell us about Dustin?
He was a challenging child to raise, particularly when he was young, because he was borderline autistic, so he was very intense. And we had to really work on his social skills to get him to fit in at all. But as with many autistic people, he also had unusual talents. He was extremely intelligent and capable of learning things scholastically very easily. So that by the time he was a senior at UCSD, he had a internship at a biotech firm in La Jolla and was looking towards a promising career.
Wow.
Just before he died, it just 7 days before his 21st birthday.
Did he ride with you a lot?
He got into mountain biking in junior high.
Mm-hmm.
And I enjoyed riding with him quite a bit. And by the time he was 15, I couldn't keep up with him on the climbs.
God.
So he became a fairly good rider. He wasn't, the head of the class, but he was a decent rider.
Did you ever get him on the tandem?
We have two sons, or mm-hmm. we had two sons, and we had actually two tandems at one time. And
okay.
Trudy would captain one,
mm-hmm.
and I would captain the other, and the
wow.
boys would. Wouldn't ride on the back.
Wow. Okay. Well, it's been awesome talking to you. I have just such great respect for you. I mean, you've something as devastating as this, and being able for you to soldier on, and not just soldier on, but to have advocacy and the kind of power go forward that you have. What can you share for those of us that are left behind? They have to keep going when they lose a child.
Well, I mean, of course, something like this just hurts so badly. It takes a long time to get over the pain. And in talking with other people with similar experiences, the first 3 years are just awful because it hurts every day. But eventually, even though you never totally get over it, the daily pain lessens, and it's not always right in front of you. Although it certainly, I still, am aware of it every day. And the first thing we took away from it early on was that things just happen. There's no reason. It's just stuff happens, and if stuff happens to happen to you, then you just have to move on and be glad for what you have, and be glad that worse stuff hasn't happened to you.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the initial set we took on it. We don't have a religious outlook, and with that mindset, we've just moved on, and we're glad to have had and known Dustin those 21 years. He was a great person, and that was his whole life. And some of us have longer lives, some of us have shorter lives, and we need to just really do the most with them that we can while we are alive.
So do you take inspiration from Dustin? Does he, when you're having a difficult situation or something's coming up that's really seems implacable, a wall that you might not be able to surmount, and you think, well, Dustin, I could be not here, or what would
well,
Dustin...
Well, yeah, you just go, well, I could be dead, so this
exactly, is... yeah, yeah, okay.
Yeah, enjoy okay. every day and do the best you can with it. You know,
Wow. Sure. So would you reckon, are there support groups, or did you just figure this all out on
that,
your own? Or?
That didn't seem to work for us, or, or it wasn't really something that... I had a few people seek me out who had lost children, and it seemed like they were looking for me to fix their problem. So, but I still enjoy or try to do what I can for people that have recently experienced a loss and try to share with them how you know, it hurts like heck now, but. You know,
just
over time, you'll come to appreciate the life that your child had, and you'll feel better.
And did you hear that from people? Had people at all kind of intimated to you that time's a great healer? Had you heard that refrain before?
Yeah, I talked to a local newspaper reporter. Told me how it was when he lost his wife, and just sort of illustrated how, as the distance or the time gets further away, the hurt, you know, the hurt scale goes down.
But it's funny, when that happens, when you're in the middle of it, I remember myself when I was going through my head injury and the process, and my mom died, and having to learn how to walk again and talk, and all the skills that were no longer mine. And I kept hearing from people say, well, over and over again, I kept hearing that time's a great healer. Give it time. Mark time, you know? And I just was kind of like, oh, you know, you're not in my place. What do you know? Was that kind of your reaction at the time?
Well, no. I mean, you're looking for some kind of solace, you know? Mm-hmm. So it's nice to know that you may not feel this bad for the rest of your life.
Okay, yeah. You know? And as the Bible says, and this too shall pass.
That's true.
I guess, if you want to do the Bible on that. Huh. Because, I don't know, I just can't at all imagine, you know, you gave your life to your son. I'm not trying to kind of make this, bring you back to a bad place with this, but I just need for the people that are tuning into this to understand how it's just horrific this was, you know, and you've just powered on, and I mean powered on. No one would know that this ever happened to you. The only reason I know is because I probe a lot, I guess. And I had to get it from you, you know? So, wow, Kirk, I'm blown away by who you are. You're a powerhouse of the highest order. You really are. And is there anything you'd like to add? Anything we didn't touch here with regard to Kirk's Bike Shop and Kirk Newell and Dustin and your life and the Greenway that you're supporting, and our ride that we're doing next this upspring?
Well, just touching briefly a little bit more on the subject we just finished with, I had kind of an epiphany about 3 years after Dustin passed away. I suffered a mini stroke and was in the hospital. And up until that time, I really didn't care if I lived or not. I just, you know, was going through the motions. And when I was in the hospital and realizing that you know, it's possible that this could be it for me, it made me realize I really did want to live, and I really did want to do more things.
Wow.
And I wasn't finished. And so from then on, I you know, I'm not going to say I felt better about it, but I just felt more directed and driven again.
Awesome.
After that stroke.
So. Uh-huh. Wow. Okay, well, that's I'm glad you augmented with that little bit of epiphanistic circumstance, because there's a lot in there what you just said, and that's kind of how I feel for my head injury. I feel like every day is a celebration. Well, we're just about out of time, so I'm going to have to wrap up on that note. Kirk, thanks for your time, guy. We'll talk soon.
Well, thanks for talking to me, Martin.
All right, man. Thank you, Kirk. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
That wraps up another edition of the National Bicycle Greenways Mountain Movers podcast series. We hope you enjoyed it. This has been NBG director and Awake Again author Martin Krieg. To access this podcast in the future and to hear other shakers and movers that we've interviewed, go to bikeroute.com.